COP28 is just around the corner, and USFRA CEO, board members, and ambassadors will be attending this year. COP is an annual meeting of delegates from nearly every country to negotiate global goals for tackling climate change, present their individual countries' plans for contributing to those goals, and report on their progress. Is your organization planning to attend COP28? Are you interested in speaking with a farmer on the ground? Connect with us at usfarmersandranchers.org.
U.S. Farmers and Ranchers in Action connects you to the leading minds in agriculture. Join Farm Food and Facts host Joanna Guza to explore the latest in sustainable food, fuel, fiber, and more across the value chain.
According to a study, school meal programs in the United States feed approximately 30 million children each day and account for the majority of the child's milk intake. Today, we're going to dive into a recent study done in 2021 and 2022 on the parental perception and children's preference and perception of fluid milk in school meal programs. We will discuss ideal flavor, packaging, and the next generation of milk drinkers. We are joined with one of the authors of the study. That's Dr. Marianne Drake. She's a professor in the Department of Food, Bioprocessing, and Nutrition Sciences at North Carolina State University. Dr. Drake is also the director of the Southeast Dairy Foods Research Center. Her research is focused on understanding how processing steps influence flavor and consumer perception. We're also joined with Dr. Eric Bastian, and he's the vice president of Innovation Partnership at Dairy West and the director of the Western Dairy Center at Utah State University. Eric plays an important role in connecting students and processors to research. Well, if you've been listening to Farm Food Facts, we typically don't start on kind of a negative type question, but I think this is really important that we kind of paint the reality of what things could look like if milk wasn't served. So, Eric, if you could start our conversation, what are the consequences of not serving milk in schools?
To kick this off, I think that serving of milk gives so much nutritional benefit to students that when we don't serve it, then we're compromising those nutritional outcomes that our students would otherwise have. And so I specifically want to mention a couple of things. I mean, a lot of people, when they think about dairy and milk, they think about minerals, particularly calcium. And it certainly is important. And I want to make mention of that and mention of that there are other minerals in milk that are really important as well. So calcium and the other minerals are critical. But I want to talk just a little bit more today about protein, because a lot of people misunderstand protein. We have a sense that if I'm eating any protein of any kind, it's all good, it's all the same. And that's just not the case. All proteins are not created equal. And we have a term that we use, we call it quality. And when we talk about protein quality, we're not talking about that it's fresh or that it's clean or any of those kinds of things. We talk about protein quality, we're talking about how much of the essential amino acids does a particular protein deliver. And there's none better than milk. And we know that most of the plant proteins, there are some good ones there, but they don't deliver the same level of these essential amino acids that milk can deliver. And as we have our young children growing, interacting, playing, they're very energetic, and they need a high quality protein. Again, a protein that delivers good levels of essential amino acids, and they get that from milk better than any other source.
Right. It truly is a nutritious product and just one form of protein that kids can receive. Now let's dive into that study. Marianne, from the study, what is the parental understanding and perception of school lunch milk?
I will follow up with what Eric said, that protein and protein quality are actually things that, before I go down the road of what parents think, but protein and protein quality is something that the consumer is starting to be aware of. Consumers really don't know much about protein at all, but they know it's part of a healthy diet. And they've heard the word complete protein, and they will tell us over and over again in studies that we do that are not part of the school lunch program studies, but studies on protein beverages, protein bars. They will tell us over and over again they want protein, they want more protein, and they want it to be a complete protein. Milk is a complete protein. Plant proteins are not. Consumers have no idea what a complete protein is, and yet they will tell us over and over again they want a complete protein. They have no idea what it is. Along those lines, when we ask parents about school lunch milk specifically, parents will tell us what other consumers tell us, and that's that they know that milk contains vitamin D and that it builds strong bones and it has calcium, and they know it has protein. Beyond that, they don't know anything else about milk. They believe it's healthy. They believe it should be part of the school lunch program, but they are unaware of the additional benefits, health benefits for themselves as well as for their children that milk provides.
Can you give that high-level overview of what is a complete protein?
A complete protein is one that would deliver, as I've already stated, the essential amino acids. There are 20 amino acids, and we need all of them in our body, but many of them we can synthesize from other sources like sugars and things. But when it comes to the essential amino acids, we cannot create those within our own bodies from other food components. And so we have to eat them. Okay, that's a very important point. And when we don't eat enough of those essential amino acids, then we start to compromise our ability, for example, to grow. A lot of people talk about bone and they only think about calcium, but bone is 60% protein. That's what gives it its tensile strength. And so we have to understand that along with all the muscle mass, the protein, the organs, everything that's going on within our bodies, that ability to put into us those complete proteins that contain all of those essential amino acids at levels that are needed, okay? And that's a critical point that we have. So, for example, when we talk about milk versus plant-based beverages that maybe even on the package claim to be milk, but they're not really. Those products, I mean, if we look at almond beverages, for example, those would have 1 gram of protein versus the 8 grams that is in a serving of milk. And the quality of that protein is not nearly as good. So you're going to have to consume somewhere around 12 times the level of almond beverages compared to milk just to get enough protein. And keeping in mind that the quality of that protein, the completeness of that protein is not there.
Thanks for laying out what a complete protein is, Dr. Baston. And Marianne, you made the comment, it seems like parents are for school lunch milk. Now, what is that ideal flavor? And I'm not sure if this is from the parents' perception or the children's perception when it comes to school lunch milk.
Parents have specific preferences or a specific perception of what the ideal milk is. But we've also done studies that we published in 2019 and 2020 on what children think as well. So, you know, from a parental perception, if we ask them conceptually, what's the ideal milk, they're going to tell us a 2% fat milk is the ideal milk, overwhelmingly, consistently 2% fat. This also reveals another place where parents don't know a lot about school lunch milk. In addition to not knowing that the milk has complete protein, they're also unaware that school lunch doesn't serve 2% milk. But we see an overwhelming preference for 2%. Across all parents, it didn't matter whether it was flavored or chocolate. And if parents are most familiar with that gable top milk, they do know that milk is served in a gable top plastic carton, probably because that's what they were served when they were in the school lunch system. So we see that parents will tell you 2% fat, flavored or unflavored, and in a gable top carton. And then when they're provided with options for what the pasteurization or heat treatment should be, they conceptually tell you it should be ultra pasteurized. If we go to the other side and work with children and ask school age children what they would like, children overwhelmingly will tell you that they want a screw cap HDPE or PET bottle. And that's because they don't like the process of opening that gable top carton. We also know when we do taste tests with children, the gable top carton imparts a detectable unpleasant flavor that is not liked by children. It's actually not liked by adults either. In the studies that we did with parents, we didn't have them taste school lunch milk. We've actually had children taste school lunch milk in different packaging. So children will tell you conceptually they want a screw cap HDP or PET bottle, and they would like, and they definitely prefer milk packaged in an HDPE or PET bottle. Children will also tell you we gave them the options of what's available in school, and they would say conceptually they would want 1% fat over fat free. However, when we've done studies with children, if the milk is free from packaging related off flavors and we don't have visible cues, children don't have a fat preference. That we could go down a big rabbit hole with how we make great tasting milk where fat doesn't impact the flavor. But the reality is that the best tasting milk under reality, not ideal conditions, the best tasting milk is going to have at least 1% fat in it, whether it's unflavored or chocolate. And we would see that parents and children would tell us that in taste tests.
So you've mentioned a little bit about the functionality of the milk packaging. Is there any other items within the packaging process that impacts milk choice?
Children would like to see a graphic. If you're giving them an option, children would like to see a graphic. They prefer something that tells you what the product is, either a photo of a wave of milk or a photo of a cow. We've done studies with that, and they'll tell you that they actually prefer to see those things over a licensed character or an athlete. Now, some of that could be skewed to the age of the children. You know, we worked with younger age children, 8 to 12. Perhaps older children would have a different preference. But if we project this onto what adults think, adults generally like photos of cows, cows on pasture, something that conveys that it's milk over other types of packaging as well.
So we've been talking with Dr. Marianne Drake. She's one of the authors of these studies that we're referencing. Did age, gender, or other demographics impact their choice?
That's an interesting question, because we actually looked at that parameter and it did not.
Was that surprising to you?
I actually thought so. Again, we were working with the age of 8 to 12. I can't project how that would be for 12 to 17. But within that primary school, elementary, middle school age, I actually thought that gender might have some preference, that girls would be a little bit touchier about flavor and preferences for milk, but we did not see any gender effect.
That's very interesting. And also, I know Eric referenced some plant-based alternatives, but Dr. Drake, I'd like to get your perspective. What are parents' perceptions on dairy milk versus plant-based alternatives?
We actually had a study that we've been talking about where we actually asked parents about school lunch milk. But we had a different study where we actually looked at parents' perception of plant versus milk. So plant alternatives versus dairy milk. In that study, we weren't focused on school lunch milk. We were instead focused on what do you think about milk and milk alternatives, and how do you feel about that in terms of serving it to your children. And what we see is that we still have an overwhelming positive bias for parents and young adults in general towards dairy milk. The yellow flag, I guess I would say, or the caution that we get from that study, is that of that overwhelming response where there is still an implicit positive bias towards milk, we see that all of those individuals grew up drinking milk and self-reported that they remember commercials and having their parents telling them they had to drink milk and all of these things. These are the things that establish those habits that establish their positive attitude that they have right now. Those individuals, though, more than a large percentage of them, do not encourage their own children to drink milk. So they still have a positive bias towards milk, but they are neutral in terms of encouraging their own children to drink milk. And they also, about half of those individuals say that they are very confused about the messaging for milk versus milk alternatives and all of the media information that's out there. And so, you know, what we would conclude is that we still have a game that it's set up in our favor to win, but we are losing that advantage because this current group of individuals are not necessarily going to be giving that same impression to their children as their children grow up.
Really interesting. And I know lab grown is kind of a new item that's coming down, not super regulated. Is that something that's going to be in the future of your studies?
Actually, we have done some work on precision fermentation. Good. Or animal free, which is what's being touted. We've actually done work with adult consumers right now in the last year, focused on, you know, how do you feel about precision fermentation protein versus, you know, animal protein, dairy protein, plant protein. And you hit the nail on the head. Consumers already have, because they've been bombarded now for the last 5 to 10 years, they already have ideas implanted in their heads and in their feelings and belief systems about what plant protein is and its potential benefits. It's a brave, new, unknown world when it comes to precision fermentation protein. And I think the cautionary thing for us as a dairy industry about that is that, you know, we did some work with consumers, we did surveys, we've done focus groups. And in focus groups, we had them talk about what they thought. And what we found was they really didn't know what it was. And then we had them go home and do what you would do to find out about what this product is. And then we're going to have another focus group, a follow-up group, after you've done your air quotes homework. And they came back and they were filled with all kinds of opinions. And the cautionary thing is that they found all these opinions because they went to the internet, And there's nothing out there except the opinions of the companies making these products. You have to really dig to find any government information or published source. And so what that means is that the consumer is being educated entirely by the companies that are making these products. You know, not that they would tell us lies, but the companies that are making these products, their job is to make these products appealing and tell you everything about them that's going to make you want to buy them. And so we have a consumer where it's a blank slate in terms of their education. And all of their information right now is coming from the companies that make those. Now, one of the things that we did see was that consumers came back and told us, about half of them said, well, you know, these products really are not animal free. They're being called animal free, but they're really, I don't see how that's really vegan. It's not really a vegan product. It might be animal free, but I'm not convinced that's vegan. We did see consumers come back and say, this seems very confusing. I'm still not convinced. But we had other consumers that were completely convinced, oh yes, this is animal free and this is going to be exactly the same as milk. And yet, and I know Eric will follow up on this, you know, this the precision fermentation dairy beverage or precision fermentation milk is not milk. It's one protein in milk. Milk is comprised of multiple different proteins, many with some very amazing bioactive benefits that we are just now starting to investigate and establish. A single protein that's been rehydrated to the same grams of protein per serving as natural dairy milk is not going to be a replacement for that product. And I think that's something that we as an industry need to be prepared to educate consumers about.
I can tell that you're really passionate about this topic. So thanks for sharing all that background. And we're going to kind of talk about, you know, what's next for the next generation of milk drinkers. Marianne, I'd like to get your perspective. And then Eric, if you could add on this, in one of your studies, it says dairy product consumption is motivated by both familiarity and habit. What does this mean for the dairy industry and promoting dairy?
Oh boy, I mean, you're really asking me to climb on the soapbox on that one. It means very similar to what I just mentioned in our previous discussion. It means that people like what they're used to. And it means that if you grow up drinking milk, you are much more likely to be a milk consumer and a dairy products consumer. That the habits that you have as an adult, many of them, whether they're good or bad, and we're only talking about food here, but those habits are established when you are a child. And it means that access to the school lunch program and fluid milk is not only an awesome vehicle for healthy children and giving them a nutritious meal that's going to give them the backbone for their best learning opportunities and their best health, but it's also our opportunity as an industry to establish ourselves with that consumer as they grow up and mature. And that means that we should be providing not only a nutritious product, but we need to be providing our best tasting product so that these consumers still want this product as they grow up and as they have more choices. I'll let Eric take it from there.
Well, I'm going to go a little bit personal. I grew up on a dairy farm, and so I was exposed from birth on to milk, you know, animals being around. And to this day, it has made an impact on my choices when it comes to food. And anyone who's been around me knows that I don't just talk the talk. I consume dairy products pretty readily. You know, my milk consumption is probably over a half a gallon a day. And so I'm living it. Mm-hmm. And it's because I grew up with it. So the thing about being familiar, that experience, that background cannot be replaced. And so as we look forward now into these generations where we have a lot of urban people in our country sending their children to school, they don't have any kind of a farm connection, don't understand maybe a lot of them where the food products are coming from. We have opportunity in our region to take these children on dairy farm tours. And it's amazing. The children can't believe what we do in terms of, you know, working with the animals, collecting the milk, taking care of those animals, and the cleanliness that we have on so many of our modern dairy farms. It's pretty amazing. And so these children are impressed and amazed by that, and they love it. Mm-hmm. And they haven't experienced it before, to the point that you're talking about this experience, this background, the habit, the familiarity.
So what they're doing as a child is impacting how they're going to eat as an adult. So when should we be getting into the classroom? I know the fourth grade curriculum in Wisconsin is focused in on, you know, agriculture. Should we be connecting with students younger than fourth grade? And is that critical to then make their perception good of dairy as they get older?
I don't think you can start too young. I think that children in preschool can go out to a dairy farm and do a tour. I mean, here at North Carolina State University, our department is vertically connected to our farm, and we have a dairy farm that does consumer outreach and entertains school-age children of all ages on a regular basis. The sooner they can get out to that farm and see where their food comes from and see that cows are valued animals that are treated very well, because you can't get good milk if you don't have cows that are healthy and treated well, and see how wholesome that is, and see that this is where not only milk, but all kinds of wonderful things like ice cream and cafe lattes. Eric's going to smile because he knows I have a real fondness for that as well. Cheese, cottage cheese, butter, all those things. And children need to see those things as much as their parents. And we see that happening all the time as well.
So now we have this research. How do we educate the schools and, you know, government programs? And if I'm missing any other key organizations, Eric, from your perspective, how do we educate people about it?
We have to start with our checkoff promotional activities and the people that work under this. We have, you know, states and regions that have ability to go and teach and show the nutritional benefits of these products to children in schools. In our region at Dairy West, we have a team of dietitians. They're in the schools every day doing nutritional education. And we just need to make sure that what Mary Ann's doing, the research, the results of the research that she's collecting, that gets into the hands of our dietitians. And I sometimes feel like that we're not that adept at getting that message out to our nutrition educators. We've got a lot of them across the country that are embedded within the Dairy Checkoff program. And I feel like that's where we have to start, is with our nutrition education people that are already in the schools doing nutritional and dairy education, but they don't know what Mary Ann's done, many of them, and we've got to fix that.
And what about the decision makers in D.C.? Is it important that we're getting content to them so that when items are being passed regarding the school lunch program?
That's a very important and a much harder challenge for us. Yes, we need to get in front of those people. I think we have certain industry groups that can help us to, because they have lobbying already as part of their focus. At Dairy West and the other state and regional promotional groups, we are not allowed to lobby. So we can't have much of an impact in Washington, D.C., and we have to rely on some of those other industry partners who can go in there and do some of that lobbying with those people. But it's critical and it's important. And every few years, they gather a group of scientists and government officials, and they kind of reevaluate what's needed nutritionally for people, not just children, but adults as well in the United States. And as they go through those exercises, we have to be in front of them with this information.
Right. And I know I use the term educate, but listening to Eric share all those examples, we're actually engaging people. You know, people are already very smart. It's engaging them, and so they get that experience with dairy and dairy farms. Eric, and actually, Marianne, I'd like your perspective on this too. But Eric, you can answer this first. You know, does the dairy industry need to be more creative instead of just drinking fluid milk at schools? Is there other ways that we should be implementing dairy in the school?
First of all, let's get a little more creative with our milk. I mean, when I go into schools and I see that, you know, the children are drinking milk from a gable top bottle, and the milk in there, as Marianne has said, it doesn't stay good very long in those cardboard cartons. Man, we should be getting creative on packaging that we talked about earlier in the podcast. We should be getting creative with some of our flavoring and what we can do with sugar. Marianne's done some work to look at how do we reduce added sugars in milk and still give a nice sweet product for children. Maybe she can talk about that a little bit. We can get creative with milk itself. And then beyond that, the creativity can extend into other products. I mean, I know that in addition to milk, children love some other dairy products. What do you think they love besides milk? They love cheese. Pizza is one of the favorite foods for children that I bump into in this day and age. And probably it was when I was a kid too, although I didn't get much of it. And so, you know, we can get creative in school lunch food systems to bring some of these great products to these children that they love already, including cheese, milk, and yogurt. I haven't mentioned yogurt. That's another one where there's a good health benefit from taking yogurt. And I don't think our school children get probably enough of that product.
Marianne, your perspective?
Well, I'll echo Eric that, you know, dairy is an incredibly nutritious vehicle that provides the things that the school lunch program needs. And I do think we need to think outside the milk carton. Yes, there are things that we should be doing to make the product that we are introducing to our future consumer taste better. There are certainly a lot of things that we could do to make that milk packaged more appealingly and to make it taste better, because the packaging that we currently deliver it into the school lunch systems is the worst system that we could be using to deliver a good tasting product. But there are also other innovations that we can do. There are plenty of things, and we've got a lot of published studies on this. We can take more sugar out of that chocolate milk. It's already a very nutritious product with very little added sugar, but we can take more sugar out and replace it with sugar alternatives. We start to be getting some different opinions from parents when we start doing that. I mean, there's a cost for everything. If you're going to pull sugar out, you're going to have to put something else in there. There are also other things that we could do if we want to go beyond milk. We certainly can hydrolyze the lactose. You know, if we have people that are concerned about lactose, we can hydrolyze the lactose and then harness it for sweetening power. We've done work on that. The other alternative would be to think even more magically and let's pull the lactose out by membrane filtration. And while we're pulling the lactose out by membrane filtration, we can concentrate the protein and we can deliver a milk beverage that is milk-based and has milk protein and has twice the protein content of milk. And now it doesn't have that sugar, doesn't have the 12 grams of lactose. We can now add a few grams of sugar back in, and it's going to have a nice sweet taste for a flavored chocolate milk. It's going to have twice the protein, and it's going to be lactose-free. We have the technology as an industry to deliver beverages like this into the school lunch system. We just need to be able to implement that. So I think the dairy industry has the tools. We have the tools in our toolkit and the research, both the technology, the research technology to make the product, as well as the proof of concept that children and adults like these beverages. I think we need to think creatively about how to get that into the school lunch system.
And how do we do that? That's like the million-dollar question. Is that somewhere in between the supply chain? Is that talking to packaging? Is it reaching out to the school directly? How do we make that happen?
Well, there are two things. So the school lunch guidelines are federally mandated. So we have government regulations, and then you also have cost. And so I think those two things are the doors that have to be opened. I don't want to call them barriers, because I don't think I think they are doors that can be opened. We just have to want to open them.
Mm-hmm. Marianne, one thing you talked about was lactose-free. For parents that might be listening that have a dairy intolerant or dairy sensitive child, how can we make sure that we're incorporating that into the school lunch program?
I believe that school systems, and I'm not an expert on the school lunch guidelines. I believe school lunch guidelines are required to offer some lactose-free alternatives. But I think currently, if you have a lactose intolerance, it's not a lactose-free milk that is offered as the alternative. I think as an industry, we need to be looking at how to get milk in front of children that have a lactose intolerance, because lactose-free milk and the technology to manufacture it, there are two different basic ways to do that. And that technology now has been harnessed and in effect for more than 20 years, more than 40 years on one of them. So these are not new technologies. We just need to get better at educating our consumers, educating our school systems, and educating the individuals that make our federal guidelines and provide these offerings. Because Eric, please back me up or let me know if you don't agree, because I think while we're talking about lactose intolerance, dairy's always had lactose-free alternatives. But I think we have our competitor industries that are moving in and saying, no, we're a better lactose alternative. And that's not the case.
One of the things, Joanna, that hits me frequently is as I'm talking to people and they say, well, I'm lactose intolerant, is they'll say, I can't eat cheese. And I'll say, well, what kind of cheese are you eating? Well, I used to eat cheddar cheese. And I just want to make the point that cheddar cheese is essentially lactose free. There's so little lactose in cheddar cheese that people can consume that. If lactose intolerance is the issue, they won't have a problem with it. Okay, that's one point I think that we have to understand. Coming back to the milk question and lactose intolerance and children. You know, the World Health Organization has gone into sub-Saharan Africa with products to deliver significant nutrition. And the thing they're looking for is calorically nutrient-dense food to take into those children who are malnourished. The product that they came up with is a blend of peanut butter and powdered milk, what we call non-fat dry milk. They blend that together and give to these children. Those children in sub-Saharan Africa are all lactose intolerant. But the observations have been, and this is coming out of places like Kenya and so on, that when the children have consumed these products for a month or so, the lactose intolerant symptoms start to subside because our gastrointestinal tracts can adjust. The bacteria that reside in our colons, and there are a lot of them and we need them to be there, they start to adjust to the presence of lactose and the symptoms start to decline. So that's one point I think that we need to understand. The other point is with the technologies we have to remove lactose and reduce lactose in milk, we can absolutely do it. Marianne's correct. The tools are all in our kit, but it costs a little bit of money to do that. That doesn't come for free. And so at the school level, when we start bringing these products in and say, well, it's going to cost a little bit more, then everybody says, no, we can't take that if it costs any more than what we're currently doing.
We need to look at that little cost now and that big impact in the future when they are adults and then they have less health issues and, you know, so on. Obviously, we can tell there's a lot of passion here. So thank you guys both for your time. And I just have one more question as we wrap up this episode and kind of from your viewpoint, will millennials, Gen Z or Gen Alpha continue to see the importance of dairy, even with people drinking less fluid milk at home?
As we've looked at the data, families with children, even though fluid milk consumption has been declining, still have fluid milk in their refrigerators at home. A huge percentage of them do. And so it's there. They have it in their refrigerator at their home. Now, they're not consuming as much of it as on a per capita basis as maybe they did in past times, but it's still there. And so if we can just get some of this messaging out to them, it comes back to taking work that Marianne does and spreading it much more broadly out to the people within the country. It comes back to making these things known to people. I think that's where a big piece will be. And I don't care the generation you come from. So I guess I'm a baby boomer, so maybe I shouldn't say anything about millennials or Gen Z or Gen Alpha or any of the rest. But okay, you know, look, nutrition is nutrition regardless of what generation we belong to. And we all need the kind of nutrition. We've talked about minerals, we've talked about protein, we've talked about lactose, we've talked about other things. This massive pool of nutrition that dairy offers to us can't be ignored by our people. We've got to make sure they understand what it can do.
Those are tough statements to further embellish upon. I'm Gen X, and so I'm the generation everybody forgot about and didn't care about. I think that's the truth. No one cared about Gen X. We were lost in the middle. At the end of the day, the power is in our hands. We will determine, we as an industry will determine what the next generations think about dairy. And I think we need to think beyond expecting people to eat or drink what we make. We've got to get beyond expecting people to buy what we make and instead turning that paradigm around and making what people want to buy. People, parents, adults, every generation still want to buy things that taste great, and they want to buy things that taste great and make them feel good about eating things that taste great. Dairy provides that. I think as an industry, we need to be better at communicating those things effectively and strategically to these consumers.
Well, thank you, Dr. Drake and Dr. Baston, for your sharing your expertise with us and dedicating your careers to the dairy industry. We recommend that you check out DairyWest.com to learn more about opportunities in dairy. And if there's a topic you'd like to learn more about on this podcast, please send me an email directly to podcast@usfraonline.org. Until next time, I'm Joanna Guza for Farm Food Facts.